Welcome to the Click Sergeant podcast. I'm joined today by Kayla Wills. Kayla was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia at the age of 12 back on Friday the 13th, 2009. She underwent intensive inpatient treatment followed by 2 years of maintenance in the paediatric hospital. Just as life was getting back on track and completing her A-levels, she received the devastating news she had relapsed, but at the same time felt relief in finally it being confirmed. Further treatment started and she received a sibling donor bone marrow transplant in January 2015. She's the eldest of four and currently studying adult nursing at Queen's University Belfast into her second year. An avid actress, writer, reader and crossfitter, she talks today about her own cancer experience, life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Welcome Kayla, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, yeah, can't complain. So, take us back to Friday the 13th, 2009 and what it was like then to be told that you had ALL.
Okay, so I've been dealing with leg pains for a few months beforehand where I couldn't sleep. We were going to the doctors and he said it was growing pains and even printed us a whole sheet on it, but he did note that I looked quite pale.
Okay.
So he sent me for a blood test, which I had on the 12th. And then I went into town with my friends that day, and on the ride home, my mum rang me and said that they wanted us up at the hospital the next day.
Okay.
So the next day we went up to the hospital and got blood taken there as well, and basically they told us that I had acute lymphoblastic leukemia, of which I had a bit of an idea of what it was because I'd actually read two books like that year with characters that had it. Unfortunately, those were like teen tragedy books, so
right, okay.
I wasn't too pleased.
One's like Fault in My Stars or Fault in Your Stars, like that sort of.
Yeah, book. there was one about someone in the moon or something like that, or
okay.
Before I Die or
okay.
Weird ones. So you know, a lot of tears, a lot of going into town, getting pajamas and slippers
right, okay.
And dressing gowns, and
yeah.
Basically that morning. You have leukemia, we want you back in at 4 o'clock today, and you're going to start on Monday.
Did it feel like an absolute whirlwind or rushed, or do you feel like it all now makes sense in your head about how that step-by-step process went?
Kind of both.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, kind of the speediness of it, compared to, you know, like, you know, if you have a tumour that's low-grade, you might be waiting months, or it's a watch and wait, whereas with leukemia it's basically same day
mm-hmm.
admission onto the ward. But yeah, it's a whirlwind because you don't know what world you're going into, so
yeah.
You can only kind of prepare with the things you have, and you don't know what you're going to be facing.
Yeah, and what was it like as a 12-year-old going onto a ward then? Because you were inpatient for the start of your treatment, were you?
Yeah. Really boring. TV had like two channels. There was no Wi-Fi. My dad had to buy a dongle.
Oh, really?
So he did, yeah.
That was probably used up pretty quickly too.
Yeah, we commandeered the ward laptop. I wasn't ever the type to go out into like the play or to the day room bit or anything. Because most of the children would be quite young. I think the next girl down for me was maybe about 10.
Okay.
Or so.
And did you do that on purpose? Did you not like to see children who were sick, or more just that you just felt that you couldn't interact with them, or what was the reason for that?
Probably more the first one.
Yeah.
I'm quite, whenever I have like a stressful situation or something like that, I'm the type of person that will isolate themselves.
Okay.
Kind of pull myself back from everything so I can figure it out by myself before I allow myself to kind of enter the real world,
okay,
as it were.
What did that look like then during treatment? Were you like just quiet, reserved? Did you speak to doctors, nurses, or did your parents speak for you? Or
parents spoke for me. For
yeah,
sure. Yeah, I would just sit on the bed and not really talk.
Okay.
To anyone, just kind of.
Would you talk to them?
To my parents?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. To my parents and my aunt and my grandparents
okay.
and all that. But only the most kind of perfunctory statements towards the doctors.
Okay.
Like, yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, but yeah. Mum and Dad then would probably be like, well, she's not actually fine. Yeah. She's got this and this yeah. and this, and this is what happened. Okay, cool. And that initial treatment then, what did that look like?
So that was 3 weeks of intensive therapy. You had your... I don't can't remember if it's Donna or Doxa Robeson.
Okay, Doxa.
The one that makes your pee pink. That one. You have bone marrow biopsies. You have lumbar punctures. You have vincristine. You have cyclophosphamide. And probably something else, but I can't remember.
You're like an amazing armchair pharmacist right there.
Yeah.
Listing these off. Were you Pickline, Hickman line? What was it like?
Hickman line the first time, yeah.
Yeah. And did you see like a play specialist who explained these things to you or how that all go down?
No, I didn't really need that.
Okay.
What I did was I got all like the leaflets that were really there for the parents.
Yeah.
Got all of that. I got the, because I was entered into a clinical trial, so I got. Took the book about that that I'd given my parents, and I just
digested it
all until I knew exactly what yeah. everything was. I didn't need anyone to.
Was that important for you to have that information to fully yeah. understand it, so you knew?
Yeah, yeah, I'm the type of person that has to stare at the needle as it goes in, and you know, I need to see exactly what's happening so I can process what's happening.
And there is times where. We're kind of waiting and watching to see how your body reacts or takes to the medication yeah. stuff like that, because there's not much that you can actually see or do.
Yeah.
Was that hardest for you whenever you couldn't see things happening or if things weren't being done?
Yeah, it's a bit tricky because what I would imagine with a tumor, I think, not that I've had one, thank goodness, is that, or should I touch wood? Touch wood right now. Is that there's something physical there that you can see. It might be like if it's on your lung or something, it might be impacting your breathing. If it's on your neck, it might be impacting pot. You know,
yeah.
it's impacting yeah. your health. Whereas with leukemia, it's hard to understand that it's all over your body because it's in your blood. So you can't, you're not actually really that unwell.
Mm.
With it, so it's very hard to feel quite physically okay, bar, you know, the nausea or,
yeah.
you know, the hunger from the steroids or something like that, but still be told that you're actually quite sick.
Yeah, yeah. So after that initial inpatient treatment where they blasted you with all that medication you talked about, then what was that after? Was it under a maintenance plan for a period of time?
Yeah, or? Well, so they had a little thing called consolidation, and basically, that was about 4 weeks, and it was just an injection of something, I think, that's called cytarabine.
Mm-hmm.
Smells quite disgusting. Injected in, and then after that, it's maintenance, you know, barring any infections and things that might pop up along the way.
And for anyone who's listening that doesn't know what maintenance is or is about to start maintenance for themselves, mm-hmm. what did that look like for you?
So for me, on that plan, maintenance was daily small doses of a drug called mecaptopurine and weekly doses of methotrexate, oral methotrexate. And then once a month, I would have to go in for an injection of vincristine and 4 days of steroids.
Wow. Okay. For how long?
For about 1.5 to 2 years.
Okay. So then that brings us to 1.5, 2 years later. You're what, planning to go back to do GCSEs at that stage?
Yeah, well, I was diagnosed in the February, but I was back in school in year 10 in the September.
Okay.
So I'd already been in school, but obviously, you know, you're disrupted. You have to go out every 2 weeks to a month or things like that. But yeah, by the time maintenance ended, I was finished fourth year going in the...
Into final GCSE going year.
Final GCSE 5th year.
And how was that? Did you feel like you had lost out on quite a lot of...
I think, looking back on it now, I think my passion for school certainly took a hit. I think kind of I started checking out by then and not really being that interested
okay.
in it anymore. But I mean, still interested in the subjects I was doing, but not maybe as much as I would have been if I hadn't had the diagnosis.
Yeah. And then you started in your A-levels.
Yeah.
And then was it in final year, in upper sixth or seventh year, some people call it, that's when you relapsed?
Yeah, so I finished my A-levels. So it was the summer before everyone was starting university. I got really severe back pain one night. I think my grandmother just put like about 5 layers of deep heat on it just to kind of make it go away. And then I went to London and was diagnosed with pneumonia. I had to spend the day in hospital while my mother and siblings gallivanted around the world of Harry Potter.
Oh, no way.
Mm-hmm.
They left you and they went to London.
Yeah, my mum came with me to A&E because we went at night. Thank God for the London night buses. Mm-hmm. We went at night and then my dad took over in the morning and they were like, okay, bye. We're going to go to Harry Potter world. So pneumonia. And then 2 weeks later, I was at home, still wasn't feeling great, and, you know, still quite sore and everything. So my mum said, look, why don't we just go get a checkup, you know, just to make sure everything's okay or see what this is. And in my head, I thought it was a relapse because I was having some similar pains to what I'd had the first time.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get that out of my head.
Had you shared this with your mum? Or was this just...
Which is why I think she said to go up to the hospital itself.
Okay.
And get a checkup, just, you know... I mean, I think she thought it was nothing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. So we went up, and then the next morning they rang and told us that they wanted us to come back up. And then we just knew. And actually, funny thing is that it didn't show up in the numbers.
Oh.
So, full blood count, all the numbers, perfectly healthy, perfectly normal. It's only because that it is their protocol in the children's hospital to individually look at each slide of blood at the end of the day. So, I mean, thank goodness it was such a minuscule amount that it was only showing up on the slide rather than in the full blood count, whereas I think... The first time when I went in, it was, you could clearly see on the numbers that there was something going on.
And so did you start back into the pediatric world to be at that age, or did they?
No. I think it was very kind of sad for all of us because we'd been with these doctors for so many years. But I think if I'd been 16 or something, they might have made a case. But because I was 18, I was an actual legal adult, then I had to... go straight over to the city hospital.
Yeah. And how was that then going from the team that you'd, that had been around you and the consultant that had been with you since you were 12, so what, 6 years?
Yeah.
To then being told you're, because you're an adult, you have to go over to another hospital and start all over again, meeting new people.
Yeah. I think it was pretty emotional for all of us. But the doctors there knew the consultants and things in the...
Yeah.
In the city and could vouch for them, so we weren't too apprehensive, just more apprehensive about what it was compared to, you know, a child environment.
So what was life like then in an adult hospital to get treated?
Boring.
Yeah.
Lonely. Because I was 18, I was able to get an isolated room by myself.
Okay.
So, I mean, luckily they have free view televisions.
Yeah.
In the ward, so I could watch that all day, every day. And in the children's there's like a bed beside your bed, so your parents can sleep on that. In the adults, obviously, there's not.
Yeah.
So, kind of your parents come and go as their jobs.
Yeah.
Dictate rather than someone is with you 24/7.
Did you want that? Was that something that you wanted your parents to be there 24/7, or was it that you would like to have had that?
Yeah, it's not so much that I would have even interacted with someone 24/7, but just to have someone there, beside, you know, just have someone else in the room, would have been quite nice. Because I remember they came in on the Monday morning and said, we're going to do a bone marrow biopsy. Probably be tomorrow afternoon. No, it would be this afternoon, tomorrow morning. I was like, okay. 20 minutes later, a junior doctor comes in and I'm like, hello. And he's like, I'm going to do your bone marrow biopsy. I'm like, there's nobody here. You know, so having to do things like that by yourself is quite...
Yeah.
Daunting. Quite character building.
Was it different getting a bone marrow biopsy done as an adult compared to a child? Because
completely. You're not... And when you're a child, like... For the barest of things, you're put under general anaesthetic, mm-hmm. so lumbar punctures, all that. An adult, you're not at all. So, a lot more pain than you would like to deal with, but it's not so bad.
Yeah, and then did you do the exact same thing you described about wanting to know all of the information, reading all of the booklets, or did you not do it this time?
I kind of knew all the information. Okay. The one thing we really wanted was because in the children's they had a little timetable of the weeks and the days that you would have certain things on. So we made the staff on the ward make us one of those.
Love it.
But I kind of knew everything. I think I was just tired.
Yeah.
But it's like I just couldn't be bothered.
And when you said when you were over in the pediatrics the first time that you kind of. It, like, became a little bit more recluse and start mm-hmm. talking to people, and at that stage your parents were there to talk on your behalf, but this time they weren't there that much. So did you do the same? Did you not talk as much to staff and then your parent waited for your parents to come speak for you, or how did it look?
I spoke a bit more, but still not more than I needed to. You know, answered their questions and everything and made small talk or whatever, but I wouldn't have been engaging with them at all.
And in that time, did you meet somebody else the same age as you that had been through cancer?
No, not when I relapsed.
No. When was the first time then that you got round to meeting somebody else who had been through?
Well, so when I was on, there was a girl on the ward, I'd heard of her. She was getting a stem cell transplant, but unfortunately with infections and things like that, we never got to meet. I think the first time I met people was maybe, I think that December I got to go to Look Good, Feel Better event. And I think that was the first time in this iteration that I actually met people, not going through leukemia, but going through some cancer in general,
Was that important to do that, or is that something that you feared a little bit about meeting somebody else?
No, not really, because I wasn't really... Like, in my head, I wasn't going to be able to identify with them because they hadn't been through...
What you'd been through?
Leukemia, I mean, I only met someone who'd had leukemia... last year.
Yeah, I remember that day. You were like, yay.
I was so, you know, inappropriately happy because that was the first person as at my age that I had met that, you know, hadn't just had cancer when they were a baby.
Yeah.
Or something like that. That was my cancer. That was, you're my age.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk.
Yeah. Would you have wanted that at that stage?
I think it would have been nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... I don't know how I would have. I probably would have said no to meeting someone when I was in hospital.
Yeah,
it's only after I got out that I wanted to engage with people.
Yeah, because it was when you got out that's when I first met you. When you'd came to Lorena and said that you wanted the opportunity to kind of like. Put your experience into a play and write some stuff and perform some stuff, and we worked together with Rini and Andrea and ArtsCare to put together that what was it called?
Hello, My
Name's Not Cancer, which was a really powerful multi-medium creative platform for people to tell their cancer experience through music and drama and art and performance and group acting as well as monologues. Was that therapeutic for you, or how was that experience?
That was a great experience. I was never really that musical, I was into art, but not really art therapy. For me, it was always kind of, you know, writing and poetry and, you know, even if I wasn't talking to people, you know, the people I was texting,
mm-hmm.
you know, there would be pages and pages. I've always felt that writing is kind of where, you know, I can safely let out a lot of emotion in
yeah.
that. So it was quite good for me to do that. And it was really nice to have other people there sharing their experiences
yeah.
and how they kind of express themselves
yeah.
through. Because I think drama therapy or whatever is kind of a more underutilized.
I would agree. Yeah.
Therapy in comparison to music and art, but I think my mom told me once that she was having conversations with like Lorena or your Weenie or someone like that around this time when I got out, and they just said to her that it's like, I don't even know who this girl is. She's
mm-hmm.
a completely different person to the person you would have met in a hospital bed,
yeah.
which I would agree with, probably.
Yeah. Do you see a very different person today, even who did the girl that was doing that performance, what, it was 3 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. But I know myself, if I had to go into hospital for anything again, I'd go straight back to being the person in the hospital bed, because
yeah.
that's just
the way you cope.
Yeah, it's almost, I almost liken it to, if you imagine yourself, if you imagine who you are as a little tiny avatar
mm-hmm.
in your head, you're front and center all the time maneuvering. What I did was I put that avatar right to the back.
Okay.
So, you know, let her go sit in a darkened space and process this. You know, I'll keep everything in motion.
Yeah.
Up here, but I'm not going to engage with you. I'm not going to talk to you.
It sounds like you were protecting that
yeah.
avatar almost.
Kind of a one-track mind to, I'm going to let you do the healing back there.
Yeah.
And I'll just keep us going.
Yeah.
Until you're ready to come to the forefront again.
And in reflecting now, do you think that was a healthy way to do it?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I think for those intensive bits, it was good because you didn't necessarily feel too much. But I think it's very hard to pull yourself back.
Yeah.
You know, to take yourself, right, okay, we're done now, we don't need to do this anymore. It's very hard to get back, to not keep that kind of in motion
mm-hmm.
thing going. So I think if you can find a balance between it, it works.
It works,
but sometimes it kind of go on a bit long.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that the way that one person copes is
yeah.
going to be different.
Yeah,
to the way
exactly.
Else.
I mean, I know people who would put pictures up in their mm. hospital rooms and make it feel like a home, whereas I was like, this is not me. This is not anything to do with me. I do not want to know a single thing about this. This is, I'm not living here. This is, I'm just here for a bit and then I'm going, I'm not getting attached to this.
Yes. So the Kiva Wills who exists today, how is she different?
She's very world weary.
Yeah.
Today. Is she kind of, I think I understand myself a bit more. I'm not necessarily afraid of the things that I used to be. I kind of have a bit more knowledge, a bit more experience
yeah.
about the world. It's quite funny in nursing when, you know, people look at you, say that you're 23, and it's like, oh, you know, what would you know about life?
Mm.
It's like, well, actually, I would know quite a bit about it. I think kind of having the confidence to be open and honest about, you know, struggles and being able to be like, okay, well, no, I am struggling in some places, or this is a place where I'm finally starting to feel more like myself, or things like that. I've got a, can I swear? It's a PG.
You can swear away.
I have a very low tolerance for bullshit.
Oh yeah?
So you see things like I always say, like for example, Love Island was on. Very popular TV shows. I understand. I love myself. Like trashy television, Real Housewives of New York, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Love it. But what I just couldn't, like for example, with Love Island, what I couldn't get were these games. People were playing and not talking to each other and not, you know, and there was nothing else going on. I just couldn't get into it. So things, you know, where people think that they have to be someone else or play a game with people, or, you know, you can't do this because the rules say that you got to do this. It's like, I have no time.
Yeah.
I have no time or inclination or patience for any of that type of stuff.
And were some of the friends that you had at these times, and that, did you have that same realization then? Because I would have some of the young people who would say, the drama that my friends were worrying over was the last thing I thought about, because I was facing mortality at times, so I just didn't have the time for them and their drama.
Do you know what? No. I have had a fantastic group of friends.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've had a group of friends I live beside, and we've been friends of like 15 maybe 15 years,
yeah, okay.
if not longer. We've been through like so much together. So, you know, they'd be the ones calling around to my house every day, being like, "Is Kevin just, you know, kind of pushing themselves in when maybe they needed to push themselves in?" But also giving me time to be like, "Well, that's just Kevin. Sometimes she does isolate herself. We're not gonna judge. We're all a bit weird, so
yeah.
So we all kind of stick together like that. In school, it was different. In school, you know, I just kind of been like hearing about the drama rather than being, you know, I kind of like being more the mediator, the advice giver role, rather than someone who was actively
causing the drama,
involved in any of that stuff. But on the whole, I haven't really had to deal with too many bad friends.
Okay. And I mean, they're really interesting qualities that you said about your friends, about the ones who know when it's the right time to call and the ones who give you your space. Any other qualities that your friends have that you, that's what makes them great friends?
They're just really funny.
Yeah. Then they laughed with you about having leukemia?
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, in 2010, one of our group passed quite suddenly. I mean, to this day, we would, you know, be joking about and laughing about it. Like, one of my friends, he was in San Francisco and he got, like, grazed by a bullet. I mean, he's fine and everything. But, you know, we would be like, oh my god, like, you barely got shot. And, you know, even, like, my sisters and everything, you know, my sister Maeve, because, you know, touch wood, everything so far has been not relatively straightforward, but, you know, probably the best we could hope for in each situation. She just likes to tell me that I barely had cancer, like all the time. So that's good. And then they, you know, they're just there.
Yeah.
You know, in a, you just go sit and watch TV with them, or you can go hang out, or you can go to dinner with them, and it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
It's the same everywhere. They don't expect you to be anyone else than who you are.
Do you find though, when you come to some of the cancer groups, that exists in a different way or doesn't exist? Do you think there's different expectations or?
I wouldn't be one for generally opening up and being generally vulnerable with people, which is something I'm working on. It's like I asked my friend the other day, I was like, when was the last time you saw me cry? And she's like, I think we're like P6. Like, genuinely. Whereas, I'm always open and honest with them, because that's one thing I'm really strong on, in my experience, is that cancer should be talked about frankly and honestly, and you know, like it's a, you know, like it's a common cold, you know. Otherwise, we'll never really get over it. But I think with things like CrossFit and the cancer groups, it's the unsaid that's more comforting. It's like you can go in, you know that you have this implicit connection with every single person that's there, and you can talk about it if you want to, or you don't have to talk about anything at all, or you can, you know, in between sets or something like that, or workouts, you can, you know, say, oh, I have, you know, this scan tomorrow, I've got clinic on. Doing it, and everyone automatically gets what you mean. You know, you don't have to explain yourself because everyone gets it.
Yeah, because recently I find that these conversations that are happening in the groups are, they're almost like rolling off the tongue, like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to Nando's and I've got a scan tomorrow. You know, like that, whereas before, maybe 2-3 years ago, people just weren't having those conversations. It wouldn't have been till after someone's scan and somebody would be like, oh yeah, I had a scan last week, I was really nervous. Whereas now people, I feel, are actually saying it not to seek attention, but more just for some sort of understanding or empathy from the...
And see, it's even nice to be like, did you ever have like anxiety about this sort of thing? Or, you know, did you ever worry about that? Or did you ever, were you ever on this drug? You know, so you can kind of compare experiences, maybe not feel quite so alone in your own journey.
Yeah. Do you get that from your friends, or is it nice to have that from that group of people?
I mean, I wouldn't get that from my friends because none of them have ever been through what I've been through. Even though they're all extremely understanding and, you know, are very curious about what I've been through, they can't quite understand in a way that, you know, the ones in the cancer groups do. And that's okay. I don't mind that.
You don't want it in other places.
I don't think everyone needs to fully understand you all the time.
We talked recently about kind of taking back control of a lot of things, and one of the things that you really focused on is not just your health but your fitness as well as your diet and stuff like that. How has that been after treatment? Has that been a long journey?
I am one of those people that if you just tell me lie on the sofa all day and watch TV and eat crisps and pizza, I will absolutely choose to do that over nearly everything else in the entire world. I am a creature of comfort. I have what, 5 blankets at home, and I'm just constantly in them. But I remember one thing that was different from the 2 experiences was when I was younger, the advice at the time was to take things easy, rest a lot, you're going to be quite fatigued, so you don't have to really do anything. Whereas when I was 18, it was like, no, you have to actually
get up and move
because that'll alleviate the fatigue. So I remember my dad taking me every day. He used to wake me up at 8 and make me eat breakfast and then make me get out of bed at 8:30.
And well, you'd eat your breakfast in the bed?
Yeah, it was like a big lovely queen bed. It was great.
Okay.
It used to be porridge with like apple and cinnamon, and it's still like my favourite breakfast. And then he'd make me walk to the Dunn Stores, which was through the Armour Park. And then there's like a hill. It's not necessarily that steep. It's long and sloping.
Yeah.
And walking up that, it's like took, you know, what's now maybe a 10-minute walk was like a 20-minute.
Yeah.
Labor, you know, over. And then when I would have clinic appointments, we would have to walk to the city, which is a 35-minute walk, and it's, you know, even walking up like the tiny hill to get in there was
the worst bit.
The worst bit. So I was actively against all of that, and then I went to London for a year and I was just walking everywhere, and then I was feeling quite isolated, so I decided to join Pure Gym just to see people who weren't like my housemates every day, and sure, get into it a little bit, and then you had mentioned about the CrossFit thing. I'm like, oh, I kind of heard about CrossFit. Yeah, sure, let's go. And now it's just fueled, kind of. I don't think I'll ever be a gym bunny. I don't think I'll ever be someone that, you know, wants to rack up a PR all the time. But I do often quite find there's a bit of solace in lifting something heavy and going, you know,
yeah.
I, from someone who couldn't walk up a hill without getting out of breath to, you know, lifting a heavy bar off the ground, it's...
You're lifting sometimes, especially in the shoulder press, as much as the guys are.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said this to you, that you underestimate your own strength.
Yeah.
And there was a period where I felt that you were... And what we would call sandbagging, where you just weren't pushing yourself, or you were going lighter in the weight because you felt that it was safer that way.
Yeah, you don't want to.
Whereas now I think you're kind of you've got over that, and like that workout you did the last day where you were just, I don't want to row, I'm going to run. And like that wouldn't have been the key, but a year ago you were doing your couch to 5Ks and
I know, it's like oh, I got to work on this. I mean, the burpees are going to take a while, but you know, it's like, oh, I actually kind of do like,
yeah,
you know, feeling this way. I kind of like having worked for something and then seeing the results of that work.
And they're not always fast, are they?
No, certainly not.
And you're a good example of somebody who used that self-discipline, especially in that running. You identified it was your weakness.
Yeah.
You did the couch to 5K, you did the app stuff, and you started running. And then you started some interval running between the lampposts and stuff like that. Even when you went on holiday, you were still walking and running, which is good. And when I say running, you're not running like marathons, 5Ks, 10Ks. Maybe like 20 minutes of out and about. And the more that you did that, the more that that's kind of translated into other ways, like your lung capacity, being able to sustain a workout, you know, control and reading your body. I think you've got far better at kind of reading what way your body wants to move now.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. If you were to give advice on somebody who is after their treatment,
mm-hmm.
and is thinking about, I really need to get things back in on track, what would you say to them?
It's going to be a long process.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen overnight. You may be dealing with some mental issues, so watch out for that.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother told me many years ago, there is a wall and you will hit it, and it will be intense, and it might be tomorrow, might be next year, might be on your wedding day. You don't know when you're going to hit it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I hit it in April. Just had like what I would call a breakdown, but my mum said it wasn't a breakdown. You know, when I was on, I got on citalopram, talking to someone now, so that's, but just to be conscious of your own mental health and to not shy away from it.
How do you check in with yourself around your mental health?
You have to be able to recognize some of your behaviors. So one of my big behaviors is I will kind of numb myself through watching YouTube videos or just flicking through tabs on the computer.
Yeah.
You know, keeping my mind and eyes active so I don't necessarily have to think about anything, which is okay for a time or two, but it's not something you should be indulging in daily. So it's maybe recognizing things that for you, maybe some of that aren't coping strategies, but avoidance strategies, and kind of seeing that, oh, maybe this isn't so healthy for me. After all, maybe I need to try something new. Start engaging. You know, even if you don't want to engage with people, like engage with the local cancer groups and whatever, mm-hmm. because everyone knows what you've been through, and you know, everyone knows that we don't all like to talk.
Yeah.
All the time. Sometimes you just want to go there and sit in the room and kind of watch everyone else be around you, but you're still there.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's baby steps. Don't expect too much of yourself at once, because you're going to burn out.
And is it worth saying that it's that asking for help, was that difficult to do, or is it scary, but actually afterwards you're so thankful that you didn't?
Yeah, no, it's certainly, I don't like asking for help at all. I'm one of those people, I've always thought of myself as very self-sufficient, and that it's not anyone else's job to fix me, it's my job to fix myself. You know, I always have thought that it's all on me, all my issues are on me all the time. But thank God, I mean, in April when I kind of started feeling that way, I had the wherewithal to stand back and go, Kiva, I think you need.
Yeah.
I think you need a word with yourself and a word with a doctor. So So I made an appointment with a doctor, and you know, it was my primary GP. So it was fine. I think by then I was kind of ready to talk to someone, but that wouldn't be how it would be usually. So I can attest it is very scary, and sometimes it only happens because you can't hide your emotions in front of everyone all the time.
As in, you'd ran out of a lot of masks that you'd been putting on, or just that?
Yeah. I think energy, brain noise got too much, masks ran out. My mum saw me crying in the middle of McDonald's, so you can't really hide that.
No.
And she said, are you going to see a doctor? I'm like, it's in 2 weeks.
Okay.
While, like, crying through tears. So, I mean, she knows now. It's easy to talk to her and kind of, but it was still, even with friends and things, I'd be like, I'm just letting you know I'm having a hard time and I'm on these pills. But it wouldn't necessarily be like, guys, I'm having a really hard time.
Yeah.
And, you know, start, like, I would never be that.
You're not using still a quite, sympathy I'm, to...
Yeah, I'm still quite restrained.
Yeah, got you.
In terms of...
But it sounds like with your friends, that's the way that works for you guys. You turn around and saying, listen, going through a difficult time right now, but I've got it sorted, I'm just letting you know.
Yeah.
And they seem like the type of people who would then check in with you every so often.
Yeah, no, in their own completely, way. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think everything we've been through as a friend group has kind of just solidified that.
Yeah.
In for everyone. And even if you're feeling crap, you can still go and they'll make you laugh, and then you're like, okay, feel a bit better.
Do you regret making that decision to go and get help?
No.
No.
Not at all.
So if somebody was listening to this, and that their biggest fear is actually speaking those words or saying, I am struggling or I'm not doing okay. Actually, when you do that,
do you
instantly feel much better? Or do you
God. I went on, and I have to say it's not a bad thing to have to go on tablets either. You know, I will say publicly that I'm on citalopram at the minute. It's not, but then again, I think I cried from like April to, you know, end of May.
Yeah.
Really, but over time it does, you know, you have to give things like this time to kick up and get into your body. If you do have to take a tablet, then, you know, and make sure that you find what's working out for you. So I was very lucky in that. I had a placement for nursing in the June, and I was offered by my head of year, who was amazing in the school, that, you know, I could postpone that if I wanted to, and then I said no because I'm a creature of habit and comfort and routine, and, you know, if I knew 3-4 days a week I had to go and do this, and that was the better decision for me. But it's like going to the gym. No one wants to go. You wake up, you don't want to go.
Yeah,
you don't want to go. But you know, the most regretted workout is the one you didn't do.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So, you know, you might feel good for a while, but over time, you will start to...
Do you think that we pay a lot of attention to the physical impact that cancer has and not enough on the mental impact that cancer has?
I think there's a lot of information. A lot of charities are doing very good things with drawing awareness to mental health. I think... it's more perhaps the way sometimes people talk about cancer.
Yeah.
As in the general public, that can have a bit of an impact, because for me, people saying, you know, oh, you're so brave, you're such a warrior, using those analogies, for me specifically, I can't stand that, because half of us are going to get this thing. You know, I don't feel like I'm braver than you. I don't feel like I'm...
Yeah.
You know, stronger than you. It's like you can't put someone up on a pedestal like that, because then sometimes, you know, people might feel like they can't be anything other than that strong person, especially if, you know, sometimes you might feel, you know, I can't let my parents or siblings or friends see me like this, because they already have to deal with me being like this. Yeah. I can't put anything more
on them.
Onto them. So I think that's a big thing, and that's why I think speaking just like as it's completely a normal thing is so important because it kind of demystifies or
untaboos what mental health
it's kind of like it deromanticizes it a little bit. Do you know, it's like people you talk about like consumption, and it was this awful thing, but it was kind of in this little glimmer and whispers and everything. Whereas I think cancer's kind of got the same sort of thing. People don't want to talk about it, but it's kind of this, you know, otherworldly thing. It's like, no, it's not. It's here. It's in your, it's in your body. It's in your cells. Like, talk about it.
Cool. I like that. It kind of reminds me of Rebecca, when we were doing the Lonely of Cancer, and she had done a monologue, and one of the things she said was, don't tell me I'm brave because I didn't choose to take on cancer.
Yeah.
Tell me I'm brave because I chose to climb the Himalayas or because I chose to jump out of the plane. It kind of resonated with what you just said there.
Yeah. I mean, in these things, you know, like I was never, like, my family's attitude and my attitude towards it was like, this is not something to victimize yourself over, or to be like, oh, poor you, you've got, you know, like, there are things that you can't do, and that's fine, you need help with that, but, you know, if you can stand up, you can do the dishwasher, you know, you're not going to get away with everything.
Especially if me, it's just telling you, you just had cancer.
you know, I think, my dad always says, my filigree, you can't play top trumps with people. Because you win some and then you lose, I had leukemia, I've had a bone marrow transplant, but you had like a tumor in your lungs and you've lost a leg and you had a stem cell transplant on right really quickly, but you have really bad side effects and it's, you can't ever try to beat someone.
So the final two things. First of, if you could offer hints or tips or suggestions to someone who's about to go on treatment, what would you give them?
Get a Netflix account.
Okay.
Sign up to all the streaming services you possibly can.
And hope for good Wi-Fi in the hospital.
And hope for really good Wi-Fi. It's not a crime to want to just shut yourself off, but try and kind of poke your head out every once in a while just to keep yourself above water. Also, the drugs are going to do weird things to you. Don't feel bad if you see your grandmother coming through the door and thinking, you bitch, what are you doing here again? Because it's not you talking, that is the drugs, that is the painkillers. The soup's quite nice.
Yeah,
lentil soup's quite nice.
Okay.
In the hospitals.
Second thing is, and that's totally left my brain. Oh, yeah. What is next for you? What does the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years look like for Keto Worlds?
Next couple of years for me is finishing my degree.
Yeah.
In nursing. Getting a nice clinic job somewhere.
Yeah.
if only because I don't mind where I work, but I need something fixed and routine and something that I know each week what I'm doing. So which is why I'm kind of I'd be quite interested in working in the oncology side of it. I think hematology is a little too close to home, but I think I could do like the day procedures in oncology. I think I could do that. And apart from that, it's kind of just trying to get back on track a little bit, trying to just live a little bit more. I don't know, go to a couple of theme parks.
Nice.
Try to go for my fear of roller coasters. Try to kind of stop being, not stop being so afraid, because I'm a very neurotic and anxious person. But try to be able to recognize that more and be able to say, I'm just gonna do it anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's a Keto Worlds 2019 compared to Keto Worlds 2017-18 when I first met you. I think there's always four things I take away from you, which is that it's that vulnerability isn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
Your lipstick is always fleck. And you always have the most amazing shoes.
Thank you.
Every time. That's what I definitely take away from you. So thank you very much for talking today. And if anyone is listening and this has triggered any thoughts or any feelings for you, then please do exactly as Kiva says and reach out and ask for a bit of help. Speak to your parents, speak to your friends, or speak to your clinical nurse specialist, consultant at your next review, or your clinic surgeon, social worker.